Welcome, I'm Hannah Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. How to Eat a Poem by Eve Merriam. Don't be polite. Bite in. Pick it up with your fingers and lick the juice that may run down your chin. It's ready and ripe now, wherever you are. You don't need a knife or fork or spoon or plate or napkin or tablecloth, for there is no core or stem or rind or pit or seed or skin to throw away. That's the poem, How to Eat a Poem, by Eve Merriam. And today we are talking about what is the power of the poem. In honor of National Poetry Month, we're talking today to poets right here in studio with us and to you about what poetry means to you and why it's important and also perhaps why it's necessary. Poets, artists, and musicians throughout history have been persecuted, threatened, jailed, sometimes killed by oppressive regimes for speaking out against injustices through their art. What does that say about the power of art and poetry to affect politics, to cause revolution, to speak truth to power? Perhaps it is true that the pen is mightier than the sword. Just this week, the remains of the famous Chilean poet Pablo Neruda were exhumed for an investigation into the cause of his death almost 40 years ago. The official account is that he died of cancer, but many people who knew him believed then and still do that he was actually poisoned in the hospital for his political views and affiliations, some of which he expressed through his poetry. So, how can poetry incite revolutions, large and small, political, social, and personal? And what poems have moved you? With us today is Giovanni Singleton, founding editor of Nocturne's Review of the Literary Arts, a journal committed to experimental work of the African diaspora. Her debut collection, Ascension, informed by the music and life of Alice Coltrane and the natural world, was awarded the 81st California Book Award Gold Medal for poetry. Over the past 15 years, she has taught poetry at St. Mary's College, at museums, at schools throughout the Bay Area. She tutors composition students at Marin Community College, teaches poetry, coordinates Lunch Poems, that many of you may know, the monthly reading poetry reading series at UC Berkeley under the direction of Robert Haas. And also with us in studio is Nick Alia, Bay Area-based queer trans poet. They host an open mic called New Poetry Mission, the new S-word show. That's the best we could do, Nick, which focuses on the production of new work. They also help facilitate a creative writing workshop at Solano Juvenile Detention Center with The Beat Within. They've just published their third chapbook, No Trees, All Pianos, and will be touring the Pacific Northwest in early May of this year. And Kim Shuck is with us. She's a poet. She's a weaver. She's an educator. Born in her mother's hometown of San Francisco, and her ancestors were and are Zalagi, Sauk, and Fox, and Polish. She earned a Master of Fine Arts in Weaving from San Francisco State. As a poet, Kim has read her work around the U.S. She toured through Jordan with a group of poets from all over the world. Her second solo book of poetry is called Rabbit Stories. Thank you all so much for being in studio with us today. Thanks. And so I want to start off really with kind of your first experience with poetry. Basically, when do you remember first that you really, you heard something that touched you? Probably as a young child. Like for me, it's like Shel Silverstein poems. I was in love with them. But let's start off with you, Giovanni.
Well, interestingly enough, I think that I came to poetry actually through music. I began very early on listening to the radio a lot, and Rod Stewart, and just remembering dancing around and it's like, wow, how can words really impact you and have you moving in this way? And slowly, I moved over to poetry probably in high school, came into contact with John Keats, an ode to Grecian urn, and I hated it. So that set me in search of things that I could relate to more easily and more readily. And I encountered first the work of Toni Morrison, who, you know, is a novelist, but I think that she gave me a point of entry into how to use language to emit or evoke emotion, landscape. It was just really incredible.
And when was this? Like
in high school.
Toni Morrison.
Actually, Toni Morrison was actually the first writer I ever met. And so it was in high school. I was about, I would say, 16 in Richmond, Virginia.
So would you say that is when you were really turned on to poetry?
Definitely. Mm. Definitely.
Teenage years.
Yeah.
All right, Nick, let's go to you. When did you first become interested?
I think teenage years also. Mm. It was senior year of high school, and I was really into senioritis and wasn't paying attention to any of my classes. And instead of trying to get good grades, I sat in the back writing what I was calling my essays. But I learned that that is actually called prose. And so I think I was around 16, 17 when I really got into writing. And it wasn't until I moved to San Francisco for college that I had really like started developing styles or reading other work. But it was 16th and Mission weekly open mic at the 16th and Mission BART station that really kind of raised me and like helped me develop into performance poetry. And that's how I was introduced to other poets and realizing that there was all this like work and art going on around me.
And Kim, what about you?
Probably the first poet I remember being particularly touched by is Dr. Seuss. But I just rearranged my shelves and put the Shel Silverstein books back on the shelf, so I'm with you on that one as well. I was madly in love with someone whose mom was Carolee Sanchez, who is a very well-known Native American poet, and her sister was also around, Paula Gunn Allen, and her sister was at the time dating Judy Gronn, another very well-known poet. So poetry has been a thing that's... I didn't even think I was a poet, really, particularly not in comparison to those women.
When did you know you were a poet?
I was on the board of directors for California Poets in the Schools for a period of time, and people kept telling me, you'd be asked to share something, and I'd read something. People would go, you know, you are a poet. I'm like, oh, you know, I'm just around them a lot, and, you know, everybody can write a little. So
and, yeah.
I was probably like 35 before I went, okay, fine, I'm a poet.
So you just succumbed.
I did. I finally did, yeah. Mm.
What did that mean to you? Like, when people were saying, oh, you're a poet, and you're like, no, well,
I'm a weaver.
You know.
No, I'm a weaver.
You're a weaver.
I'm a bead artist. I make regalia for people to dance in. I write poems in the morning because it's a tradition in the religion that I practice, but, you know.
And so what did it mean for you to then say, okay, I'm a poet? What changed?
What changed?
What did it mean to be a poet? Did you feel a sense of responsibility all of a sudden?
No, I didn't. I'd always been saying all of the political things that I was saying. I don't know. It was another name.
Right.
You know.
Giovanni, what does it mean to you to be called a poet? You're a poet.
Well, you know, I think that because I went to graduate school at New College of California, I was in a master's program in creative writing, that it was really important for me to begin to claim that name, to claim that title, to give me some direction, to reinforce my commitment. So I think that at that time it was really important. However, given the style of writing that I'm interested in, I have continue to try to explode that notion of poet and what it means to be a poet, to include what it means to be human, and also to see poetry not only as, you know, a particular set of verses or lines on the page, but to locate it in the everyday and everything that I see and everything that I do. And I'm also interested in how words come into play in terms of visual art. I teach poetry also at the Dion Museum, what it means in terms of playing music, dancing, you know, jump rope, whatever that is, to try to bring that into the field of poetry or to expand it. So it was really important to me as a beginning, as a foundation.
Mm. And Nick, you know, it's one thing to be kind of part of a poetry scene and kind of to witness poets in front of you, you know, the 16th and Mission Bart, as you mentioned. But then it's another thing to say, wait a minute, I'm going to really delve into this. I have a lot of things to say, and I'm going to be a poet. What was that process like for you, and what does it mean for you?
That was the scariest process that I've gone through so far in my life, I think. I'm relatively young. I'm 25. But about 3 months ago, I decided I'm going to commit to poetry. I'm going to commit to being a poet. And, like, what does that mean? And, like, unpacking what it means to, like, be a poet and, like, strive for that. And there was always this, like, air of pretentiousness that I felt with being like, well, I'm a poet. Like, nice to meet you, too. And people kind of, like, you know, side-eyeing. But then I'm like, wait, that's what I do, though. And, like, that's the thing that I love. And, like, poetry is my first and will be my last love. And so, like, you, like, saying that I'm a poet, took some time to get used to, like, having that word in my mouth and having that phrase in my mouth to be like, I'm a poet, I write poetry, this is what I do. And it took a long time because I had been writing for a while, but it took only up until, like, a few months ago for me to actually be like, this is what I do, and this is why I love doing it, and this is how I do it, and I want you to do it with me.
Mm. So that took some courage, you said.
Yeah.
It took a while. Well, I'd like to invite our listeners into this conversation today all about poetry. What's the place, you know, what poem do you remember from your childhood? I don't know why for me. I just go back to my childhood when I think about poetry. And what is the power of a poem to you? Do you carry a poem in your pocket? Some people do that. Do you perform at poetry slams? Is there a poem you've memorized that you'd like to share with us? Give us a call, 866-798-TALK. That's what I was going to say. 866-798-798-TALK. 866-798-8255. Or you can shoot us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Tell us how poetry has affected you. Or if you're a poet, by all means, call in or email in and tell us if you have, you know, an event going on in the Bay Area, if you have a poetry slam somewhere that we should know about, or, you know, a poet that we should know about that you'd like to share. By all means, give us a call or email us, or you can go to the website, kalw.org, and comment there. And again, with us are three distinguished poets, Giovanni Singleton, Nick Alia, and Kim Shuck. So let's, we talked about kind of being young and getting into poetry. And so now that you're in the thick of it, you know, at various stages, all of you, but I'd like to ask you, Kim, kind of what do you feel your place is now? We talked about the beginnings, but where do you see yourself now in terms of your role? Do you feel you have a role, like, in towards society? Do you have something that you're offering people around you, or is this for yourself?
Okay, well, I think my last book, which is actually not a collection of poems, it's fiction, is more of a drawing forward of a thing that I've been doing a lot of in the last 5 years or so, which is carving out an identity for urban Indian people, which I do think is what I'm called to do at this point, and it is what I've been doing. So sort of defining what our realities are outside of the stereotypes. I mean, we've got movies coming up now with the supreme stereotype native guy in it, and that's going to be a July, and that's going to blow a lot of things open. And we're also tagged with these identifiers, and so that's my real purpose. I stopped footnoting everything to explain what my terms were, and I've just succumbed to actually writing for my audience, who is generally a Southeastern Native educated woman over 35.
Hmm.
You
have a niche audience.
I have a definite niche audience, but it's a larger one than most people expect. So that I think is my to create a comfortable identity for myself to exemplify that, you know.
Nick and Giovanni, do you feel that you have niche audiences that you're kind of writing for, or does it just happen to be that this is your this is your experience? This might be your family or your people's experience that you are reflecting on paper.
Well, Dorothy Allison said that she writes for what she's against. And when I heard that, I felt like, yeah, I think I do that too. And I think that, I don't know if I have like a particular audience, but I know that a lot of the times I write for my 16-year-old self, and I write for things that I wish that kid could have heard and felt safe and, like, felt good about. And I feel like I write for myself, but I also write for queer community. I write for non-binary trans kids. I write for, you know, just to tell a story. I write a lot about fat shame, and I write a lot about rape culture, and I think that those things are intersectional, and then they can stand alone, but mostly writing for anybody that can connect to any of those things.
And Giovanni, do you feel boxed into kind of a niche type of poetry?
I don't, and that actually is a problem sometimes.
Why?
Well, often. Not being willing to be boxed in. I think that a lot of my poems I try to write as simply as possible, and I think that I'm also interested in exploring what simplicity can be, and looking at complexity through simplicity. And I look at a lot of things to see how they can be further, you know, pushed further, how I can explore form or explode it, rather. And that's really interesting to me, to sort of be a little bit fearless in engaging and indulging curiosity. I think there's just not enough of that. I'm insatiable about what it is that I don't know. And so I oftentimes come to the page and am surprised. And I don't think consciously, oh, I'm going to sit down and write a poem. It's like, I'm going to write these words, they've come to me, or I'm going to try to capture this image. And then I usually walk away from it. So poetry, when it comes out in this form, it's usually kind of a surprise to me and for me, and I really enjoy that.
Right. I want to talk about the process in a little bit. Some people speak of this divine, you know, inspiration that comes from above. Some people speak of dreaming about certain words or certain, you know, concepts, and then they wake up and they write. Some people. So I just want to take some callers and so think about that inspiration and the process. And you can give us a call at 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255 to share your favorite poem or talk about why poetry matters. We're going to take our first caller. We will go to Doris in Oakland. Hi, Doris. Welcome to your call. Doris? Hi, Doris.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Well, I'm 65, first of all. My father taught me a poem that he learned in 10th grade because he had to punctuate it on an English test, and he memorized it and then later taught it to me. Mm. And it's a poem. It's, if I can say it without crying, the doctor looked me over. "There's nothing wrong," said he. "You haven't got a fever. You're as sound can be." "But I'm not myself," I answered. "There must be something wrong." "Then tell me," said the doctor, "to what town do you belong?" "Oh, I'm from Detroit, Michigan. It is there my boy is waiting. I will go there when I can. It is there that Buddy's mother holds a little home for me. It is there are many friends I am hungering to see." Oh, Detroit, said the doctor, looking rather bored. The town of automobiles, the town of Henry Ford. I was there myself last summer with a few friends for a while, and I bet this very moment you would love to see Belle Isle. Well, tell me, doctor, what you think about my case. Oh, it's simple, simple. I can see it in your face. But I have no pills to cure you, for it's simply this, it's wrong. There's 1,000 miles between you and the town where you belong.
Oh, that's beautiful, Doris. And so you've memorized that.
And my dad taught it to me.
Your dad taught it to you, and it's stayed with you, and it stuck with you. Why?
I think because it was a poem that my dad taught me. I was a child, and there was a lot of emotion in the poem about somebody longing for something. You know, I really could feel the feelings that the person was had, and I really loved the poem.
Okay.
I mean, it's probably not the greatest poem in the world, but the emotion, I guess the idea that words can evoke such emotion.
Right, right. Well, thank you so much, Doris, for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
Thanks. She was, you know, clearly emotional, reciting the poem she learned from her father. And that's common, would you say? That, you know, again, childhood, the teenage years, and just words that stick with you in those years. Anybody want to address that a little bit? Nick, you're looking straight at me.
Well,
you're like, I can relate.
Well, I was just thinking about the emotion part of it, and how last night at the Berkeley Slam, I was feeling a little nervous. And one of my friends came up to me and she was like, be in the place that you were when you wrote the poem. And when you get up on stage, be in that place. And just thinking about how, like, emotions can take over and that can make the poem so authentic and so beautiful, like, when you let yourself, like, experience the poem in the way that you wrote it. And I know that Doris hadn't written that poem herself, but the way that she had been taught the poem and the way that she, like, has kept it with her all these years, I feel like is kind of in the same light of just, like, bringing yourself back to where you were when you first learned it.
Mm. Kim, you want to say something?
Yeah, I do. She said it's not the greatest poem in the world, but the fact is the greatest poem in the world is the one you need in that moment, you know? And if something brings you to tears, that's great. I don't want to live in a world where people can shut themselves off from things that trip their switches, no matter what that thing is. So that's all I had to say about that.
All right. We're going to go to another caller then. We'll go to Cloud Feather in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to your call.
Oh, yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Rose, Kim, Giovanni, and Nick. I'm up here on the roof in my rooftop atelier in San Francisco, and I have one Robert Graves poem that I'd like to spout, because I'm seizing the moment, and I want to send it to our friend Kim Jong-il, and it's called Flying Crooked. The butterfly, a cabbage white, his honest...
Cloud Feather, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
Can you hang on? We really want to hear your poem,
but
we really got to go to break, and I'd hate to cut you off.
No problem.
All right. This is Your Call on KALW. I'm Hannah Baba. With me are three awesome poets and awesome people on the phone as well. We will be right back.
You're listening to Your Call here on KALW San Francisco. To join in today's conversation, the phone number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. First-time callers are always welcome. We love to hear from new voices. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, the email inbox is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Programming here on KALW is supported in part by An Evening with David Sedaris. We'll be visiting San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House Sunday, May the 5th, for an evening of all new readings and recollections from his newest title, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. Ticket information at davidsedarisontour.com.
For those of you just joining us, I'm Hannah Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow is our weekly media roundtable, where we speak with journalists about covering the week's news. Monday, how will the Monsanto Protection Act affect the food supply, and what do we need to know about GMOs? And today, what is the power of a poem? April is National Poetry Month, so we're speaking with poets and you about your favorite poems, your relationship to poetry. How do you interact with it in your daily life? Is there a really special poem that you'd like to share with us right now on the air? If you do, give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can send it to us at feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. With me in studio are three poets, Giovanni Singleton, Nick Elia, and Kim Shuck. And we'd also like to invite you on to Your Call today. Before the break, we were speaking with Cloudfeather in San Francisco. So, Cloudfeather, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but now we're all ears. Go ahead.
No problem. I want to say that I am Celtic and of the Iroquois Nation, Algonquin, and a native California daughter. And my father sang story songs to us as we grew up in the Woodside Glens. And Milton John Purcell, my wonderful father, wrote many poems. And my mother, on my graduation, she gave me Khalil Gibran from high school, and my best friend turned me on to Bob Dylan in high school. So, you know, it just goes on, and I know everything by heart. I know everything by heart.
Why don't you share one with us, a short one?
Oh, my God. One of mine? Or today in San Francisco by the bay, in the Aprilis, in the blossoming month of April, I spoke with my Hannah. Is that your name, Hannah?
Yes,
Hannah. And I recalled the ninth wave of the sea when Diane de Prima read Ave in a hall that was dark and filled with women, and I'll never ever ever forget Diane de Prima and those Ferlinghetti cerulean blue eyes, and then Hirschman with his Hirschman is just done. He encouraged me because I wrote one thing called about the two birds on the rooftop. How does that go again?
It's okay. Well, hey, Cloudfeather, can you send it to us in an email?
Two birds on the rooftop, dovetailing on the rooftop.
Can you send it to us? That's okay.
We had to clean it up because it was
That's okay. Can you send it to us in an email? We'd still love to have it. Yeah, so thanks for the call.
Can we kind of cascade into the cloud? You know, the NASA people, they don't really understand the local fluff, which I think is so wonderful, the mystery of life. And one of my other little volumes is called None of Your Biscuit, where I reveal these mysteries of, you know, humor and tragedy. And the whole, poetry is the higher good in the peace talks. And here's the Robert Graves, all right?
All right. Hey, Cloudfeather, I'm so sorry, but we have so many callers today. We loved hearing you. But if you can send all of that to feedback@yourcallradio.org, we would love to share it with our audience through our website. Thanks so much. We do have many callers, so let's keep going. Let's go to Pat in San Francisco. Hey, Pat.
Hey. There was two poems that I've always that's always had an effect on me. The first one was called High Flight. Now, you're probably too young to remember it, but when TV wasn't 24 hours a day, they would start early in the morning with the Star Spangled Banner, and they would do this poem called High Flight as kind of a benediction, for lack of a better word to put it. Mm-hmm. And the last line of it was reaching out and touching the face of God. And I found out in later years that he had been an RAF pilot who had crashed his plane, lost both his legs, fought to get back in, and died in the latter days of World War II. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that poem has always stuck with me. The other poem is actually a letter by a Michael O'Donnell who wrote to his wife during the Vietnam War. And ironically, he was also a pilot. He was a helicopter pilot. And his poem is, "If you are able, save for them a place inside of you, and save one backward glance when you are leaving for places they can no longer go. Be not ashamed to say you love them, though you may or may not have always. Take what they left and what they have taught you with their dying, and keep it with your own. And in time, when men decide and feel safe to call war insane, take one moment to embrace those gentle heroes who you left behind." He wrote that in January of 1970. He was
Beautiful.
Killed in March of 1970.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Pat. Appreciate that. "Feel free to call war insane" was part of that last poem that Pat shared with us. And so I want to kind of piggyback on that, "feel free to call war insane," and talk about the power of poetry, you know, politically, globally, really. As we said earlier, famous Chilean poet Pablo Neruda's remains were exhumed on Monday to investigate the cause of his death. And the official account says he died of cancer. But for 40 years, many people believe that, you know, he was actually poisoned in the hospital for his political views and affiliations. The New York Times on Monday said the court-ordered exhumation seeks to establish what caused his death. And less than 2 weeks after a military coup toppled the nation's socialist president, Salvador Allende, a close friend of the poet. Here's a bit of his poem called "The Poet" by Pablo Neruda. He says, "I sped through the exile of each man's existence, this way and that, for I saw that their being was this, to stifle one half of existence's fullness like fish in an alien limit of ocean. And there, in immensity's mire, I encountered their death, death grazing the barriers, death opening roadways and doorways." So he was seen by many in power as a threat. So, you know, whether or not he was poisoned, you know, many people believe that he was. So let's go to Giovanni. What do you think, you know, what do you think the power of political poetry is, you know, here in the United States? You know, the Occupy movement has been embracing poetry, the civil rights movement, prose and poetry. Can poems affect change, real change for people on the ground?
I think they can affect real change. I mean, a lot of the poetry that that I cut my teeth on came out of the civil rights movement, came out of the black arts movement of the 1960s, came out of revolutionary action. And I think that it's empowering, and that's what revolution is about, you know. And the thing, a lot of, you know, politics is about the balance of power and who has it and who doesn't. And with a poem, I think that, you know, people pretty much are put on equal footing. You know, I do have a voice and I can use it. Oftentimes, you know, it is a more powerful weapon. And we know that because so many writers are coming to this country who've been exiled for writing. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of books have been published, you know, that were snuck out of these confined spaces. So I mean, I strongly advocate for it, and I encourage people to be careful with language, and as it is an extremely powerful tool. Mm. I mean, yeah.
Now, we have a couple of people who've been really asking that you share your poetry. But first, let's go through some callers. They are many, and they are waiting. Thank you for waiting. Let's go to Liz in Richmond. Hi, Liz. Welcome to your call.
Hi. I want to say thank you for the show today. I wish we had more poetry shows. I feel that poets are the voice of conscience in society, and it's coming out in today's show. Anyway, I also wanted to announce that the Crockett Library, part of the Contra Costa County Library System, is having an open poetry reading not this Saturday, but the Saturday after, April 20th, from 1:30 to 3:30. And for more information, you can go to the website of Contra Costa County Library, that's CCCLIB, or call area code 510-787-2345.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Liz. Let's keep moving on. Let's go. Also in Richmond, let's talk to Stephen. Hi, Stephen.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
I'd love to share this poem with you. This is by Lori Blonner, and the first line is the title of the poem. I've been carrying this around for 25 years or so, and now with a yellowed piece of paper that I tore out of Old Nation magazine.
Do you carry it on your person? Like, you carry it on you?
I have in the past. Right now, it's sitting on the front of my piano.
Okay.
Okay, it's called What Your Body Holds Against You.
Mm.
Could be love in the right proportions. Don't confuse form and content, where a good sense of humor become the kind of curves that make a room loosen around her. Look for a woman that listens to music drifting over a lake, hovering like flies, or someone who will watch the landscape emptied of azaleas under a setting sun with you. By 40, there is a sideshow of vanities, the dragon breath you wake to, bones tossed against your skin like waves, or the flesh that grows where a waitress tucks her loose change. We measure time with our lives, counting up the coins year by year. We all become detectives with broken hearts and off-season hotels, where love and his accoutrements wait by the roulette wheel for one chance at the big time.
Ah, thank you, Stephen. Thank you so much. All right, so let's go to the poets in our studio. We've been asked by our listeners through email that we want to hear some poetry. All right, Kim.
Yes.
Go for it.
All right. This is called The Great Urban Indian Poem.
Mm.
The great urban Indian poem has already been written. Most people missed it. The fancy dancer had finally finished his urban regalia, collected his last windshield wiper blade for his Oklahoma-Oakland back bustle, complete with Harley gas cap rosette, found himself lining up next to a redheaded San Francisco girl, her shawl edge marked with graffiti from outside of Eli's Mile High Club, and John Lee played the two-step himself. The Great Urban Indian Poem is ongoing, but most people miss it because there will never be a release party or even a book. And Deb Isle, though she may want to, will not play the event, and the tribes involved are conflicted because one of the poets has no CDIB card, and the other is from an unrecognized band that had never been more than obscure, and she refuses to wear the official tribal dress because, well, it's horrible. And it's not even historically relevant, and it makes her look like a cloth muffin. And she'd really like the cute girl in the shawl competition to look at her, but the muffin dress isn't getting that done, which is a whole other can of politics. The Great Urban Indian Poem will be found when you least expect it, and yes, parts are even scrawled onto those fussy coffee cup insulators, but only coffee from small local cafes, because culture is at its root not something that can be sold by chain stores. There will be no signs directing people to the poem, and it will not be reviewed or published in any sanctioned literary organ, but pay attention, because if you hear Jim Pepper in the background, you might be close.
Poet Kim Shuck.
Thank you.
All right. Who's next? Nick.
All right.
Go ahead. Nick Alia.
Well, given that it is National Poetry Writing Month and 30 poems in 30 days, I believe this was my second day. Mm. So this is called The Chronicle of Insects. 3. The insects found their own way out of the creek. their simple wings buzzing like summer, flaps fluttering for the unrested. They swirl around thick lights and tall grass. Their tongues stick to my skin. I walk away from the swampland with blood missing and a collection of welts. The punks on the neutral ground offer me whiskey and cigarettes. I choose the smoke because it reminds me of the girl. I choose the smoke because it is October and I can't find anything dense enough to settle in my teeth. I'm not keen on the potholes, but I let my face sink silently into them. Oh, good, I think, how ugly I've become. 2. The girl sits outside the window, her chest like swollen hives. I spy an empty carton of cigarettes swimming in her belly. She tells me that I have grown greedy and asks for her pipes and silk scarves. I tell her that the moths have come, that I've gone and hurt someone she loves. We trade coins, and that is the calm of it. 1. I keep finding dead bees on the cement. I collect their wings and try to string a bracelet of the bodies to sting her hands with. After I'm through, I'll rub her palms with tobacco and mint and pray for the rain.
Poet Nick Alia. Okay, Giovanni Singleton. People are waiting.
Okay. Well, this poem is called Jay Walker, and it takes place at Adeline and Alcatraz in Oakland. Snapping fingers, swinging arms, she goes against the flow, against the light, against her mama's and grandma's warnings. She on the phone, talking loud and being cool, not looking, not caring about direction, not caring about seeing the red, not seeing red. The heat is hot. I'm held up, trying to not plow through and get somebody hurt. I stop the flow, roll down the window. Say, is where you going worth your life?
Poet Giovanni Singleton, thank you. Beautiful. Oh, goodness, this show today is great. Let's go to more calls. Let's go to Ray in Santa Cruz. Hi, Ray. Welcome to your call, and thank you for waiting on the line.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. It's a great show. I love it. I wanted to just bring up real quick the power of music and poem, because I'm a musician, and you know I've written a lot of songs, and a lot of times they start off as a poem. Sometimes you asked a little bit about the process earlier, too. Sometimes it is kind of like a divine inspiration, where it just pops right out of nowhere. The music and the poem and everything comes right at once and flows right out. Sometimes it's kind of painstaking. You know, you have an idea, and you know that it's a good idea, and it would make a good song, but the words don't come for a while, or the music doesn't come for a while. But, you know, I mean, there's so many great musicians out there who I think are awesome poets, you know, from John Lennon and McCartney, of course, and, you know, Paul Simon, even Frank Zappa. I just wanted to bring that up, that, you know, the two go so hand in hand. You know, I mean, it's so pervasive in the culture of the world to have poetry and music as one. And I want to also give myself a quick plug. I have a Native American. I'm part Chippewa, and I have a song up for a Native American Music Award right now called White Buffalo. Mm. If you go to the Native American Music Award, if you just Google that and look for the Native Heart category, and it's called White Buffalo by Steve Graves. He's a friend of mine who recorded it.
Great. Yeah. Thank you so much, Ray. Thanks for your call. Whoa, lots of emails coming in as well. But first, let's go to Deborah in San Francisco. Hey, Deborah, welcome to your call.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the show. This
sure.
has just been fabulous. I wanted to share, I'm a poet. I've basically been writing poetry since I was 8 years old, and I have not really shared it with much of anybody until the last couple of years. And I'm 64, and I had a pretty traumatic childhood. And one of the things that I've been doing with my poetry, I just devised a new process in conjunction with my therapy work. And what I'm doing is when the deep, difficult memories come up, and I've been actually feeling them very deeply in my body. As they come up through my body, I sit down and I translate the feelings and the memories into a poem. And then after that is over, I do a a release process to release the charge from the memories. Can't get rid of the memories, but...
Is that in the form of a breathing out, for instance?
Well, it's actually a psychic, something I was trained to do psychically, but it is a very effective technique. And in conjunction with the poetry, I have taken the charge off of 10 very distinct memories that really have had a very hard impact on my life.
So the therapeutic value of poetry.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that, Deborah. Thank you so much. Giovanni, I wanted to ask you, kind of piggybacking on the question by Ray in regards to the relationship between song and poetry. And I think it was Cloudfeather earlier who said she used to, her parents used to tell her, you know, song stories are part of her culture. So what's the link there? Are they indistinguishable? You know, sometimes where's the line and there need to be a line?
Well, obviously I'm going to say there doesn't need to be a line, but if you want to get your work out there in this country, in this culture, it seems that lines are also important. You know, I think also about a recent caller about memory, and I remember growing up, I wanted to be a Soul Train dancer. And one of my first readings from my book last year was on the day that Don Cornelius died. And so I wrote a poem in memory of him and in memory of my memory of wanting to be a Soul Train dancer with some help from James Brown. So for me, I think they go hand in hand, and certainly poetry is quite driven by rhythm and the arrangement of sound. So I think, yeah, they definitely are in there together.
Right. Let's go to an email sent by Philip, and he sent us a poem, and here it is. A Parkin son of a bee squats obscenely in my brain, makes my thoughts hard to explain, makes me tremble, stumble, twitch. When he turns his little switch, everything goes hella askew. But I do what I can do to keep steady, happy, and strong, and I sing my little song that says, Parkinson's, park you. So thank you, Philip, for that one. Sheila says she shall be forever grateful to Miss Kubi, her English teacher in junior high school, who often read or recited poetry to them, performing on the stage of their classroom. The rhyme of the Ancient Mariner is permanently etched in her brain. She says she keeps books of poetry close by her bedside. When she rises sleepless, she reaches for the soul-soothing work that makes life worth living. Thank you, Sheila, for that. Margot says she staples poems to the wooden wall between her garden and a Berkeley hillside path, rather steep. She says people use the poetry wall as a resting place, so they stop and they read. And if I'm in the garden, I can hear how happy the poems make them. This makes me happy. It makes the poems happy. That's an interesting concept. It makes the poems happy. Can any of you relate to that? Do you feel you're doing the words a service, a justice?
You had me right up until, do I feel I'm doing the words a service?
Well, can you relate to what she's saying? It makes the poems happy.
Yeah.
What makes a poem happy? Just being read?
I think essentially there's an aspect of poetry that exists in order to chip memories sharper. Mm-hmm. And I think that if it suffices to do that, then the poems are happy.
Mm-hmm.
How's that for a high-flown comment?
Yeah, it's up there.
Yeah, it is, unfortunately.
I love that idea of putting poetry up in public spaces, because I think that poetry is a community effort a lot of the time, and it's really important to have, like, community involvement. So that's really a beautiful thing that she can, like, place poetry in a place that other people are going to stumble upon it, and that's super important. And the best thing that I've learned from poetry is, like, have a solid community that loves and supports.
Supports the poetry. That's Nick Alia. Let's see. Here's another another email by Sally. She says, although doggerel is not considered great poetry, again, Kim, like earlier, we talked about what's great and what's not great, right? It's relative. She says, it's not considered great poetry. I am a writer of these poems. It was sort of 'twas the night before Christmas style that I have to do at the end of each year to recap what went on in my life. It also helps to recall for memory's sake what happened, whom we interacted with, where we traveled, what happened on the political scene, how we felt about it at the time. She even uses this type of poem to send to her friends for birthdays, remembrances for obituaries, retirements, and love notes to her husband. So that sounds like a kind of a chronicling of life type of poetry. So final thoughts. We have just a couple of minutes left. Final thoughts. Poetry in your life. Where are you now? Very briefly, though. Giovanni.
Well, where I am is where I've been and where I'm going. And I mean, I think that poetry is really important, and it really has shaped my life. All of my work, my livelihood is connected to writing and to poetry. And when I go in to fill out official documents that ask for my occupation, mm-hmm. I am very happy and proud to put down poet always.
Excellent. Okay. Excellent. Nick Alia and Kim Shuck, there's the music. Thank you so much for being with us. And thank you to our listeners who really called in today. And thank you to our emailers. Sorry if we didn't get to you. This is Your Call. And on the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable tomorrow. This week, we'll discuss media coverage of President Obama's proposed changes in Social Security and Medicare. We'll also talk about the legacy of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. We'll be joined by Columbia Journalism Review journalist Trudy Lieberman, Alternet's Joshua Hollande, and The Guardian's Zoe Williams. So where did you see the best reporting this week? Join us live tomorrow at 10 or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar hosting tomorrow, and you. Thank you for joining us.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.